And those people generally are probably not going to have a great time if they're at my show. Sometimes they'll go, wow, I've had people come to me and go, like, I haven't felt emotions, you know, or something like that in a while. Mm. And I felt, you know, I've had people tell me, like, it made me feel uncomfortable, which I think that's sort of, you know, punk rock at its finest, really, is just making people feel some shit that they're not always comfortable feeling.
Welcome to Curious Goldfish, a podcast community where music and curiosity come together through interesting conversations with the music makers of our world. I'm your host, Jason English. You can find Curious Goldfish in all the major podcast and social media platforms. And of course, we have all of our content on our website, curiousgoldfish.com. I moved to the Atlanta area 2.5 years ago, and seemingly each week I learn about a new artist that lives here or learn of an industry icon that grew up here. I saw Elton John perform at the Mercedes-Benz Stadium in late 2022 and had no idea he's made Atlanta home for the past 25 years, up until recently. And we're just weeks since the Super Bowl was played in Las Vegas, where Usher performed at halftime, and apparently he attended high school in the town where I live, in Roswell, north of Atlanta. John Mayer, Zac Brown have passed through, just like countless others, from so many different genres. Where am I going with this? Well, fairly early on, after moving here, I came across a local artist performing in a tavern down the street, a little place called 1920. The artist was Davin McCoy, and I was blown away by Davin's whole persona he had going on that night. Every cover he did sounded better than the original, and every original he did sounded like something that should be on the radio. I've been fortunate to spend time with Davin ever since, and that reaction I had the very first time seeing him is still something I feel every time I watch him. Whether it's in front of a handful of people at a restaurant overlooking the Beltline in downtown Atlanta, or even at legendary Eddie's Attic. If you've seen him, you know what I'm talking about. And if you haven't, well, I'm so excited to introduce him to you as he's about to record his first album in a decade, and I'm hoping that his following will exponentially grow because he has all the talent to be right up there with those other Atlanta artists I just mentioned. This is the first of 3 episodes we have planned with him. This conversation occurred in late January 2024, just as he was about to record. We hope to catch him during the studio recording, and then we hope to get a recap of the album and deeper insights into the tracks that make it near its release. I'm hoping one of those tracks selected for the album is Rings, a beautiful song where Davin urges someone to metaphorically cut him up and look on the inside of him, just like you would do to read the rings of a tree. After my conversation with him, I'm so happy to include a recording of that song that he performed on a cold December night in the backyard of a friend's house here in Roswell. Picture a cold, dark night, trees all around, with a campfire glowing and crackling as Davin sits on a bright red stool with his guitar, and every lyric he sings is accompanied by breath from the frigid air. Pure magic. And you can even hear the fire alongside Davin. It's a thin line between making it big and not making it in music. There's no reason Davin McCoy can't be a household name after he leaves Muscle Shoals, Alabama, where he will be recording this spring. And that's where we pick up our conversation with him. Let's dive in. How did the Muscle Shoal things come about?
Through my partner Robbie, he brought Dan Hannon around to some shows. Robbie was the one that was trying to convince me to do a he was the one that wanted me to do a record, and just so he convinced me, he started the ball rolling, I guess. And he brought Dan Hannon around, who's a producer that used to live here in Georgia, and he moved to, and so he had come and expressed some interest in producing the record, and I was certainly interested in what he had to say. And then he joined this group in Muscle Shoals called the Ivy Manor music group, or I think they're like the deadly badass assassins or something is something they call themselves. But so he moved out to Muscle Shoals to join them.
Oh, cool. That's big. So it's been, what, 10 years since your previous studio album, what have you been doing the last 10 years besides, you know, not making a new album?
Right. I wrote a lot. I kept intending to make the new record. I had some, there was some legal stuff to get through with my last record label. It really kind of put a damper the way things went after that last record, which was partly my fault. That last record, we had a lot of money behind us, and it was, they'd really kind of hyped it, and the way they were promoting it, or the way they wanted to do it, and the way they were spending money, that essentially I was going to owe back regardless of how they spend it. So I had no really say in it. They would just sort of, you know, they would kind of spin it their way and then go, by the way, you know, this is the current debt, you know, or whatever. And I didn't see it ever paying off the way they were pushing anything. It seemed like we were on two really different pages. Kelly, who became she's my ex-wife now, but we got knocked up during that first year of the record. That also kind of put me in a crazy headspace. Sure. I didn't want to be gone all the time and really not making a lot of money with what we were doing at that time. And it just, the business structure wasn't there. This none of it really made sense. So it put, right, kind of left me with a horrible taste. And so when I did finally, it was kind of a slow burn split from them. So of course it was even, you know,
right,
we should have just ripped the Band-Aid off. But so I took a bunch of time to figure a lot of stuff out. And then I went through, and then I was going to put another record out, and I went through a divorce, which took forever and was horrible. And then I was ready to work on the new record, and then COVID. But the whole time I was, you know, I was working in some way with music and with the writing and all that. So,
cool. Some of your fans may be curious about, like, do you still have access and rights to songs that have been previously recorded on other labels? Like, will you ever kind of resurrect?
There's some that I did under some other umbrellas that I can't, that I have no access to. But the songs that are still up on Spotify and the records that are still up on Spotify, those I think I have.
Yeah.
I mean, there, I don't know. There could be a,
yeah,
it, we might be open to some sort of,
like redo.
Yeah. And I plan on kind of redoing especially the last record. I plan on doing sort of, a Taylor's version, you know,
love that
re-release of those records. I know you're a Swiftie.
I love that. Davin's, Davin's version.
Yeah.
Perfect.
But as far as I know, where we landed, I think I own the majority enough of the publishing.
So just out of curiosity, so are those songs like, you know, Whiskey Sexy and Happy Life and Numbers Game, things like that?
Yeah, that whole record, I'd like to do a more intimate version of it.
Yeah.
I'd like to do it with the same approach that we're approaching this new record with.
Oh, that'd be great.
Which is how we should have done it in the first. And that's not me, Doc, because Don McAllister produced that record, and Don McAllister is,
right,
he is a, he's, as good as it gets, and but it did have a lot of influence from the label, and it's just really shiny. The record is shiny, and I don't think I necessarily the shiny factor, I think, takes away from some of the. It should be a little messier, I think, you know.
Yeah.
A little more intimate, like kind of some of the. I think a lot of the kind of the scars and warts and things were sort of we would kind of clean that, you know, I'd go back in and redub a vocal if I didn't like a note or something, and just a lot of that stuff was we were all kind of caught up in it. So I think that it's a good record. I think I don't know that it's representative of what you come see at a live show.
Sure. How do you think you've changed as a songwriter or musician since that last studio album?
I think I'm a better singer, a better guitar player. I don't have as much confidence when I'm writing as I did, but not in a bad way, and more of an objective quality. I think I'm a more conscientious singer than I was. I think a little bit more about what I'm doing instead of just sort of. Before it was sort of I still kind of closed my eyes and just let it go, but I tried to learn a little bit more about what I was doing. I felt like I was always, you know, the movie Days of Thunder with Tom Cruise.
Mm-hmm.
It's Top Gun, but with race cars. There's that scene where Robert Duvall is talking to him in the bar after they'd been on the track all day, and he's trying to get Tom Cruise to talk to him about what he was feeling in the car. And Tom Cruise is finally like, he's like, I'm an idiot. He's like, I don't know anything about what's going on. I just know how to drive the car, and I don't know the lingo or the language. I sort of kind of felt that way, and I had been in the studio with, over the years, with just heroes of mine and guys that are, you know, been from Chuck Lavelle to Ryan Newell to just being around all these guys. I just got tired of feeling like an idiot when they, you know, I could write numbers for them, you know, but, and that was sort of it. Everything else was just sort of coming from the gut. And I think it's important for it to come from the gut, but it's nice if it can pass through your head before or after, and you can put like some thought, more thought into the physicality of what you're doing and based on kind of more of a knowledge of the music.
Is there a chance that you, even though you have less confidence, that you're probably a better songwriter now?
I think so. I think that I am. I think when I say less confidence, I think that I'm more open to other genres of music and the songwriting process behind songs that maybe I don't like, but I can listen and really understand the kind of the greatness behind whatever it is, whether it's, you know, it could, you know, whether it's a metal song or a Taylor Swift song or a, you know, Ed Sheeran song or a Cat Stevens song, you know, whatever it is, I think I listen a little bit more objectively. And so that is sort of the undertone that when I say less confidence is that it's just more of, I think, an objectivity about what's happening or what I'm trying to say. The other part is that I still am in love with the idea of heartbreak and isolation and then all the way to the other side of connection and that type of love that is, you know, where you still feel like a teenager waiting, you know, just when you've been with somebody night after night after night after night and you still see them and feel like it's prom night, you know, and it's the first time, you know, I as you get older, I think as a songwriter, you start to think of, you know, you can become jaded to that, those ideas, because you just experienced heartbreak so many times. You know, it's a fleeting thing.
It's,
you know,
just part of life.
Yeah, it's just something you're going to go through.
It's Thursday. Yeah.
Right. When you're 20 and you get your heart broken, it's like, holy fuck, your world is completely fucking shattered and you'll never recover, you know. And I still feel, you know, until you find that thing, especially if you get kind of bored easy or whatever it is, until you find that thing again, you're going to go through it over and over again, and each time it's, you're more aware of what's happening and that it'll, this too shall pass. But if you really, you know, if you lean into it, you can still feel those same things from that you have felt your whole life as a human being. And but some of that's, I'll sit down to write and I'll feel like this is too heavy and this is too emotional, and it feels like it feels like something a 20-year-old should write and not a man in his 30s, you know? And so,
well, that reminds me though of, like, you know, again, back to like Ted Lasso, that scene with Roy Kent where Rebecca's like, they go on a double date and she's like, what'd you think about the guy? And Keeley's like, no, he checks the boxes. He's financially fit. He's good looking, whatever. And Roy Kent's like, you know, are you bleeping kidding me? You know? And he basically tells Rebecca, you deserve to feel like you got struck by lightning. That's what you're talking about, right?
Exactly. Yeah. What I'm talking about. Yeah. And I love, I'm a complete sucker for that stuff and shows. And my emotional status, I think, has always been, it's in a way, sort of an unhealthy, I mean, I'll cry during an insurance commercial.
really?
But then if something heavy, like, important in my life happens, I'm pretty stoic of the time. And I think it's what's killed a lot of it. It's hard for a partner to be with me because they'll go, I watch, you know, I go to a show and watch you talk about a song, and then, you know, I can see your eyes watering while you're just singing a song that you wrote 15 years ago or something, or whether it's a month ago or 15 years ago. And then I've never seen you one time cry at home over, you know what I mean? It's like,
why do you think that is?
it's early childhood developmental trauma, really. It's just a safe space that I found when I was young. Emotions were not real safe for me when I was young, and not because I had shitty parents. They were doing absolutely the best they can. Right. They were great. But you know, both of my parents had come from a lot of trauma in their background, and sort of my mom sort of felt responsible for my emotions, and what happens there is that in turn you feel responsible for hers. So you don't want to be sad because she gets sad if you're sad, which is too heavy for a kid to really carry. And so you tend to be stoic through everything because you don't want to make your mom upset, and just you being upset will make your mom upset in those situations. And then on the other side of it, you know, my dad really didn't have much patience for or validation for emotions. So I just kind of had, in both houses, I just had parents that, you know, it wasn't real conducive for me. So then when I started singing music, playing music and singing it and then writing it, you know, that all of a sudden you're on some form of a stage, and not only do people sort of expect you to really feel emotions, the more you feel, the more it tends to resonate, and then they clap for you afterwards, you know. So it was this safe space where I could feel and really really kind of experience the things that you're supposed to just probably be doing in your everyday life, you know.
Well, the other night you know, we were together and I saw you do a cover of Damien Rice, and I don't know what the meaning behind the song is, but I could see it in your face, you know, when you were performing it.
And Damien Rice is, almost everything he's written, I go, oh, yeah, that's what I was thinking. He just did it a lot better than me. Yeah, Damien's a great example of that. And that song, it was Delicate, right? Is that what I did? That song has been out for a very long time. And I still, every time I decide, I don't know what made me play it the other night. But
well, I think they asked you, you know, play your favorite cover. And it took you a minute, but then that's what you landed on.
That's right. Oh, yeah, it was. Well, play your favorite cover always turns into play what right this second you would make you the I think, what you're feeling the most. Mm. And that's in that arsenal that I shuffle around for sure of songs that I know always make me sort of, they make me happy to play. And that song is so good.
Yeah.
Every song on every record of his is good.
So in terms of the songwriting, you said you've been writing songs. I mean, how big's the backlog in the last 10 years of what you have now to choose from for the new album?
It's not as big as it should be. There were a few periods of time where I wrote the same song about 100 times, probably. And it was in moments where there was a lot of shit that happened in the last 10 years. And so, you know, you have couple of kids, go through a divorce, go through another really, really difficult breakup, COVID, all this stuff, right? And right after you go through them, if you can't, there are some people that can immediately sort of recognize and write it the way it should be written when you go through something heavy. I tend to be too close to the painting for a while, and so a lot of the writing is purely, it's just therapeutic. There's nothing to really come from it. It's just a way of leaning into the emotions and feeling them, but I'm too close to the painting to really describe it, you know. And it takes some time to get a better perspective of what you're seeing or what it is you're going through or feeling. So there's a lot of songs that were written. Most of them are unusable. And then in terms of what we've been kind of sorting through for this, the ones that I've been comfortable presenting, I think I have done a pretty good job myself of narrowing them down to probably around 16 to 18 or something. And then if I really have to bring out, I've got a whole book of songs that if I get to Muscle Shoals and we think that we're needing some other material, I've got stuff I can start showing them, or at worst case, sort of a lyric and an outline of a bunch of things that we can look through and see if there's something there.
Do you anticipate doing much writing while you're there, or will it be mostly just trying to record what you've got?
Some of the team there, they are looking to write a couple of songs with me. I know that they are sort of leaning into that, and I'm very, very open to it. But I also told them that there's no guarantee. In no way am I guaranteeing that they'll be on the record. And, it's personal. Writing for other stuff is different, you know, but for the record, especially when I haven't put one out in 10 years, it's, it feels really personal, and it feels very close to me. And so if we write something that I love, then I will 100% put it on the record. And if we write something that I love, but I just don't think it's for the record, I'll just, you know, we'll use it for something else. Yeah. We've written a lot of good stuff out there this past year. So
what are your goals for the album? And you kind of described it like you're too close to the painting. Does the painting have a theme yet?
I think there's a general feeling that is... that I've already tried to, Robbie's helped me sort of through this process with kind of outlining a feeling and a theme, which is, it's pretty heavy. I mean, there's a lot of, it's a lot of emotional takes, I think, and, for better or worse, but overall we wanted to just be extremely intimate and extremely passionate. And I think that if I could sum up sort of the goal, it would be, you know, there's music to dance to, you know, and there's music to do all, you know, all sorts of reasons to listen to music. And you know, the goal of this record is, you know, for I think for people that ever just sort of feel isolated or feel uncomfortable or feel afraid or feel sad or feel manic or whatever it is, to listen to the record and feel less alone about feeling any of those things. You know, I think that's probably the overall gist. There will be people that go like, bro, lighten up.
I don't think you've heard that before.
Never have I heard that. Yeah. People will approach me and think that I'm like, they will assume that I'm going to be very delicate and emotional. And I think a lot of people are always surprised to learn that I'm really like laughing all the time.
Yeah. You're lighthearted.
Yeah. I get the heavy shit out in the song so that I don't carry it around with me all day. Because if I didn't, I would. I would walk around with it. When I'm not writing or playing, even if just not playing for a while, it doesn't matter if it's a pub or a festival or a show or a theater. It doesn't matter. I will start emotionally chewing. Like, I'm like a golden retriever. I'll emotionally start chewing up the carpet if I don't play enough. And it's probably not the most functional way to exist, but it is the way that I exist, and it's probably too late to change it much now.
Well, I think, like, if I did music reviews, I would probably start out with a review of your music with something like this, which was like, you know, there's a guy, Leo Tolstoy, said music is the shorthand of emotion.
I
would say music is the shorthand of emotion, and Davin McCoy writes in calligraphy.
Oh man. I said, can you write my new bio? I think we talked about that.
That's a pretty good line.
That's a great line.
Yeah. Because, like, you, if anyone sees you in person, it is a lot, but being alive is a lot. Having relationships is a lot. Having kids is a lot.
Yeah.
Having friendships is a lot. So it's like, that's kind of what music should be.
I agree with you. I mean, that's definitely my approach, and that's my defense and too of what I do. I mean, that's more eloquently put than I've probably ever put it. You know, and I'll have people go like, man, play something happy. You know, my very eloquent way of responding to that is normally just go fuck yourself. But
well, you've got a happy life. You've got
happy life.
Not at all. You know.
Yeah. With you. Yeah.
With you. Not at all. Or not at all.
Yeah, which both have some sadness behind them, really, but...
we don't have to tell everybody.
No, I won't. Yeah, that's mine to keep. There are people that are just... You brought up the Ted Lasso thing. Ted Lasso is a great example of... That man is, you know, he's a walking antidepressant for the people around him.
Right.
But he is, you know, I thought it was so brilliant the second season when they came back in with sort of the reality that is so... that you're going to have with that personality type, which is he's going to be dealing with something inside that he's compartmentalizing that is going to eventually come out sideways. And I think they did such a great job with the mental health aspect of that side of it. Yeah. That's the thing, is that there's a duality, and you've got to lean into both of them. And some people lean into music for that, and other people lean into to really happy music for the other side of it. And those people generally are probably not going to have a great time if they're at my show. Sometimes they'll go, wow, I've had people come to me and go like, I haven't felt emotions, you know, or something like that in a while. Mm. And I felt, you know, I've had people tell me like, it made me feel uncomfortable, which I think that's sort of you know, punk rock at its finest, really, is just making people feel some shit that they're not always comfortable feeling. And then other people, it's just cathartic to lean into it, and they tend to be drawn to, and I'm the same way. I mean, shit, give me, I'll go to a, you know, I go to a Damien Rice,
right,
you know, show over a Mama's and the Papa's show every day, all day.
And there's a market for it. I mean, some people are like, well, you know, music should be dancing and happy and things like that. But like you mentioned Damien Rice, I think, you know, Gregory Alan Isakoff also, you're not going to want to go to the carnival after listening to Isakoff, right?
Right.
But like there's a beauty to it.
There's definitely a beauty to it. There's an inner, there's a whole inner world that I think that it allows you to experience. Some people are comfortable in that space. Some people are too comfortable in that space. And some people are uncomfortable in that space. And it's just a whole different, it's the duality of the universe that exists in every single one of us, I think.
So we talked about, it's been 10 years since the studio album, but you did release something over the summer, which is a live recording at a performance at Eddie's Attic here in Atlanta. I guess, what was the purpose of that?
I think Robbie wanted me to do it. I think that was
Robbie's got ultimate authority.
Yeah, I think he wanted me to do it, and I was happy to do it. I thought, sure, why shouldn't we? That's another thing that's changed as well, is I don't feel as, I'm not as afraid of it not being, of things not being perfect or anything. You know, sort of like when they mixed down that record, I was in there for about 10 minutes and I went like, nope, I cannot sit here and listen to this. I am out of here. I trust you guys. Tell me when it's done and send it to me. Just mix it how you think, and just don't chop anything out. Don't tune anything, but you guys can mix it down and just release it, because you'll never hear me, especially in a live recording. I'll never, if it requires me to sit there and go, yes, that's great, put it out, I'll never will.
That's right.
So it was a,
no, it's great. I think that's a great, you know, having seen you a bunch the last couple of years, that's a great example of who you are, you know? And I think that's like at your purest, that's what I love, you know?
I think when I did end up listening to it a couple of times, I really did think it was good. I thought it was a pretty good representative. Yeah. Representation. And I'd like to do that. That was, we did that because our plan is, I think, to try to do release, you know, one show at least once a year. You know, even if it's, a lot of song overlap and stuff, I'm cool with it. I think it's cool to have you're just always in a different space when it's shit that means something to you. And so it comes out different in a lot of ways. So
do you think the new album will be more like that than it was than your earlier stuff? You talked about shininess and
right? This will be, it'll be much closer to, the goal with this record is to be able to, it's not going to be an acoustic record. It's going to be, there'll be plenty of instruments on it, but it'll never feel like it's me with a band, because I don't plan on really touring with a band again for some time. And so I want the record to be big and atmospheric and all that. But when you hear me play the same songs live with just me and a guitar, or me and one other guy or whatever, I don't want it to sound like different versions of the songs. I want it to sound like the same song. A great example is, you kind of hear that with a lot of like Ray stuff and Damien Rice stuff, and it's all, you know, it's produced, but when he does it, most of them acoustic, when either one of them do, or a lot of guys, it doesn't sound, even back to like Cat Stevens, you know, whatever it was, whatever the quality was about the recordings, when he played acoustic stuff for him and just one other guy, it didn't sound like this is the acoustic version, you know, it just sounded like the song.
So I hope to talk to you in Muscle Shoals while you're recording, but I guess, can you walk us through, what do you call it, pre-production process?
Oh, yeah.
What are some of those steps that you've been doing the last couple months to prepare for Muscle Shoals?
Panicking. That's probably the thing I've done the most. I've just been trying to sit with, some of these songs I've probably done them 10 different ways over the past bunch of years.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been trying to sit with those and figure out what I like the way I want to do them best. I've been sending tracks out to those guys out there to listen to and kind of get a feel for, so they can come up with their, what the production idea is. And mostly just a lot of lyric cleaning up. I've been going through and trying to, you know, there's some of these songs have 25 verses and that I've just over the years that I've rewritten. And so going back through all that, which has been kind of neat, actually. It's kind of sort of like reading your journal in a lot of ways, obviously. So I've been doing a lot of kind of lyric cleanup and trying to find versions of songs that I remembered that I liked that were recorded some way or another. And that's sort of what I think what you sort of do. You go through it and kind of just take an inventory. Pre-production is sort of an inventory. And then once I get out there and we do official, we'll do the studio pre-production, which is where we'll really sit. Before we track, we'll sit, we'll kind of draw out a map, like a brain map concept of what the record is. Dan Hannon is so, he really brings a profundity and like a weight to, he said, you know, at some point I realized that a lot of producers approach it sort of like they're making sort of their record that, you know, they have decided what this record should be, and great producers have done that plenty of times. Right. But Dan is very, I want to make your record. Mm. I want to be the one to make your record, which is pretty cool. So he does sort of a lot of, you sit down and you really, I think it's that kind of Rick Rubin school of thought, yeah. You know, you got to kind of manipulate and get the artist to the place you think they need to be in, and a lot of ping pong talks, you know. So
that should be fun.
It'll be great. I'm excited.
All right. Well, thanks for your time today. Yeah. I look forward to seeing you at Muscle Shoals.
Yeah, man. We're going to have a good time.
I'll kick your ass in ping pong.
You need to brush up on your ping pong.
Don't worry about that.
Because we will. It's intense. Are you good?
I'm good.
Of course you are.
I'm good
at cornhole. You're athletic as shit, too. Yeah, you have that walk too. You know, you walk like an athlete.
Oh boy.
I don't know. Hopefully, if you get out there and smoke me, I'm gonna be so bummed.
I'm gonna bring my cornhole boards too.
They probably have them out there. Yeah. They've also got like those splatter ball guns, the intense ones.
Oh, you told me about that. Yeah.
We get out there and make some noise and shoot each other and. We actually created a new ping pong. That's what we'll play.
Oh, that's right.
The splatter ping pong. Where you get hit with paintballs while you're playing. It'll be great. Gary Nichols, yeah, Dan Hannon, Eli, Clint, the whole team out there is really great. It's going to be a lot of fun.
All right.
Don't put that part in there because I left out two names. Yeah, I can't think of them right now.
I'll fix that in post. As they say.
Fix it in post, yeah. Cool, right, man.
Thanks, man. Yeah, appreciate it.
Thanks, Jay.
Yeah, big thanks to Jason English and Jeremy Ford for putting this on. Faces just mumbling things. My world turned dark, and now it seems the only way to find you is lucid dreams. So cut me out and turn me out and read my. I speak like trees. rock, but I was only sand. And you anchored with me until you found solid land. And everything that you held so dear, it crumbled inside me, but I kept it with fear. So cut me up and turn me out. Read my rings, 'cause I speak like trees, and burn my leaves and cut me up. Just read my rings, 'cause I speak like trees. Burn it all, take it all, everything we roll, and cut it down and cut it out, everything we know. And the toys in the attic, no one wants them to touch it off, but I'm loved. Even when times got rough. So cut me out and turn me out and read my rings, 'cause I speak like trees, and tear me down and burn my leaves and read my rings, 'cause I speak like trees. Cut me up and turn me out. Read my rings, 'cause I speak like trees. Let's go rings.
Thanks so much for joining us for another episode of Curious Goldfish. Please follow and subscribe to the podcast and on social media. Also, tell your music-loving friends about us too. Until next time, stay curious.